So I think even you can't possibly go back to what your great-great-great-grandmother was doing, because those were completely different times. We live in completely different times. But at least take some key principles and some learnings from that.
Hello everyone, I'm Ayushi Mona. You're listening to India Booked, a podcast where we lean into the idea of India through its literature. This podcast is perfect for you if you love reading books, like trivia, or just want to know more about India as a nation. Every podcast takes place as a conversation between the author and me, the host. I am Ayushi Mona and you are listening to India Book Season 2. Today on the show we have Nandita Iyer. Nandita has written this very, very fabulous book called Everyday Superfoods, which is an essential guide to understanding and adding superfoods to your diet. Now you'd think that this is a buzzword and a fad and a marketing ploy and more than an actual food group, right? But the book's really interesting, and in a country as large as diverse as India, right, it's important to examine what superfoods mean, because literally our diet is full of them, whether it's millets, whether it's turmeric, you name it, and we eat it. But as we grow increasingly westernized or urbanized, our relationship with food evolves, and today that's what Nandita and I are going to be delving in, which is how food changes our mood and how our mood and cultural anthropology examines and revisits our eating habits. Hi everyone, I'm Ayushi Mona. You're listening to India Booked. It's a podcast where we delve into the idea of India through multiple facets because of the books that amazing Indian authors write. And today I have with me Dr. Nandita Iyer. If you don't already follow Nandita on a gazillion social platforms as Saffron Trail, you are missing out. She is also a doctor, a nutritionist, also somebody who's had a bestseller to her name. This is her second book. Today, we'll be discussing everyday superfoods. Welcome to the show, Nandita. I am very excited to have you on the show. If there could be a spring in my voice, much like a spring in my step, I think this is it. So I'm like so thrilled.
Thank you, Ayushi. I'm excited to be on your podcast and talk to you about my book and other things. So thanks a lot for having me here.
So Nandita, I think the first thing that I have to tell you is an anecdote. I got the book and it came home and my mother picked it up and she started reading it. Okay. And then she reads like some 30-40 pages in. Then she like comes over to me and says, "Ye sab main bolti hu to tum nahi sunte ho, tumhe books padhne hai iske bare mein." And it was very amusing. I said, "Listen, you don't understand all of this. Okay. And this is like very nuanced and research." And she said, "Yeah, but this is how our grandparents and great-grandparents lived. This is all I tell you every day. Don't eat packaged food. Eat this, eat that. Eat at like a specific time of the day." And after I finished reading the book, she read it much before me. But after she finished, I read it. And I realized that what you've done is actually bought in common sense into eating habits, and for you, Nandita, how did you really decide that you're going to write this book? And especially because your first book, right, was very straightforward in the sense that it was about vegetarian recipes. Superfoods is contentious. It's described differently. People have opinions on it. They're either pro it, they're averse to it. And this book looks at immunity. It looks at superfoods, all of these things which are really part of media conversations around food. So now I will shut up and let you share about how did you actually get around to writing a book on superfood.
So I like it that your mom approved the book, and if there's something about our parents and grandparents and their very down-to-earth, commonsensical knowledge. And if they validated, then I'm pretty happy about my effort. And coming to your question about how I got about to writing this book, I was quite happy writing like on food and recipes and stuff. But then, you know, in the last few years, there's been a whole boom of health-related content, nutrition-related content on the internet. So be it YouTube or Instagram or any video or even very quick format like now even Reels, right? In 15 seconds, people want to tell you everything and make you understand why this is good, that is bad in terms of health and nutrition. And I feel that kind of very short-form content in this space doesn't really help anybody, because health and nutrition is a far more nuanced subject than something that can be conveyed in mere seconds. And there is no black or white, and you can't just say that is good, this is bad. You know, you can't just jump to such quick conclusions. And a lot of content on, especially on YouTube and all, if you see, and they have millions of views, these are all about instant like weight loss. Have this within 1 week, you'll lose 10 kilos of weight, or, you know, drink that and your immunity will be up. And, you know, especially now in the times of COVID, even you would have seen that in the last 1+ year, literally, you'll find that the most educated and, you know, the people who I would think have a scientific bent of mind are forwarding messages which say that keep drink hot water and you will prevent corona and all these kind of things, right? And research has shown that this kind of fake news is what goes viral much faster than somebody explaining something in detail, because nobody wants to make the effort to put in the time and to understand what is it that someone is trying to explain to me, right? And as human beings, we are so increasingly becoming binary or polarized, where we just quick that if someone says that's good or this is bad or that is like worst, you're just very happy to jump on that and believe it, because it requires absolutely zero effort from your end to understand a little deeper, dig a little deeper into that subject and see whether that actually suits you, suits your life, whether there is some science behind that or it's just something that randomly went viral on the internet. And also internet algorithms are such that something has already got 1 million views. The next time you search for that, that is always the first thing that's going to come up. So that same same explanation gets more and more visibility. Whether it's right or wrong, nobody cares. Whether it's actually good for you, no one knows. But that kind of very short form content and very you know, something that has no scientific backing, which is going viral around the internet, and people are believing in all kinds of stuff without even, you know, understanding what it is. So I that was one of the major triggers for me. And I would always get upset, like, why do these videos have millions of views? And, you know, it's actually damaging when people start following these things. So I thought the best thing I can do is maybe think of writing a book along these lines. And you know, take it step by step and gradual, and try to tell people that in your health and in the space of nutrition, nothing is overnight. So if any brand is telling you have this product and tomorrow you'll build your immunity, that is, there's nothing farther from the truth. So I think just to make people understand that, apply some common sense, have some scientific validation, and have this long-term investment into your health instead of expecting instant returns. That was the whole thing behind writing my book.
You know, when you were speaking, I just remember this one quote from Mark Twain, where he says that a lie can travel half the world while the truth is putting on its shoes.
Absolutely.
And I think that's exactly, I think, whether I think the algorithms and generally, As people, right, you want a solution. You don't want to hear it's complicated or it depends. You want to hear, hey, this is what it is. So you know, we take solace in that. And I also think that, and because you mentioned science, right, and very interestingly, you know, evidence-based medicine, right, is something also that's very contentious in India. And That's because as we believe in a lot of alternative therapies, right? We believe in food as medicine as much as food for food's sake. So whether it's like a kadha or a haldi and things like that, and a part of, I think, the whole fad around superfoods comes from looking at food as medicine. So don't look at your lifestyle, don't look at where your food comes from, when it comes, just pop this almond and eat this chia seed, and you know, it's literally treating food as something that you would like have as a capsule, right? That this is food for nutrition, food codified almost as medicine, as a superfood, as opposed to food for the sake of the pleasure of eating, for the pleasure of community. There is so much about the culture about food. So how did you really navigate, Nandita, ensuring that while writing a book about everyday superfoods, a lot of the superfoods that you've written about, you have an entire section of recipes, you've called out these 39 foods. A lot of them are also obviously considered common superfoods in fad culture, right? How did you ensure that you would be scientific in your communication and in sort of talking about the disease, you wouldn't really end up probably, adding some fuel to the fire, because it's so contentious, right? Like, you are also advocating for superfoods at the same time realizing that this entire culture of looking at food for the purpose of being a superfood is what created the problem in the first place. So how do you deal with that as an author?
That's a very deep question, I think.
All I could think of when I was reading this is like, oh my God, she's done such a fabulous job of not making this, just another series of this is good, this is rich in antioxidants and vitamins. While of course you've touched upon the nutritional aspects, right? But how do you write about everyday superfoods without making it caricaturish superfood?
So maybe this is just something you're asking me about, how I actually brought this book together. See, definitely I wanted to write about specific foods, their nutritional angle, their nutritional information, what it is good for, and of course some recipes as a guidance, because just telling people eat this, but without telling how do you eat it and how do you incorporate it in your everyday life is, it's kind of leaving out the practical aspect of it and, leaving my readers hanging as to how to go to the next step. So, of course, that had to be included. And why that 39 number? It was not meant to be like a BuzzFeed listicle or something where you have this odd number of things. But, like I've also written about it in my book about what exactly are the considerations that you would look into a superfood, especially when the qualifier here is everyday, right? I don't want something fancy that you will have to look into 4 gourmet stores and check in different websites to order. It has to be something which is easily accessible, something which is not so expensive that you can't make it a part of your everyday diet. So yeah, when I look at what are the considerations why I chose these 39 superfoods, like I've written about in my book, there were questions to be asked. One is it easily available? So it's not something that you have to check into different gourmet food stores or different websites and, try and source it from these difficult sources. Is it local? Because no point if you Google saying top superfoods, all the US websites will come first because of their high ranking and they will all say blueberries number one.
Yeah, oh my God.
Is it local and is it going to make you broke if you eat it every day, which blueberries in India definitely will, because some 100 grams is some 350 or 400 rupees. So it's not practical to include that in my list. Third is it cultivated responsibly? So if you're eating a food for its nutritional reasons, what's the point if you're going to eat like a turmeric, which is industrially cultivated with a lot of pesticides and very poor quality soil? Because ultimately the food is only as nutritious as the soil that it was grown in. So that's the reason why, as far as possible, make sure it's grown responsibly, organic or trusted organic, because nowadays organic label also, you don't know, everybody just puts it. Then is it seasonal? Because research has shown that seasonal fruits and vegetables have definitely more, micronutrients as compared to the non-seasonal ones. It also means that it has grown in its natural time of the year, and which means that the whole lot of pesticides and fertilizers have not been used to grow it. Fifth, of course, similar to the first point of blueberries, is it affordable? Because only then can we have that everyday qualifier. You can't have like very expensive food and say this is good for you, so, you know, break the bank and eat it every day. And the last thing is, how processed is it? So it's also about, if you're, say, take again blueberry, if it's coming in a granola bar, which is a lot of sugar, additives, preservatives, etc., is it worth eating that kind of superfood in that form? So always have that awareness as to how far away from its natural form a food is. So eating a banana as it is definitely, as is definitely better than eating it in a banana bread. With no disrespect to banana bread, even I love banana bread, but I'm just giving this as an example. It's even a like a school kid can understand, if you give them, say, roasted peanuts versus a chickpea versus a peanut butter bought from a store, each of these have a different level of processing. So be aware when you consume a certain food for its superfood qualities about how processed it is. So these were the criteria that I included when I was, these are the criteria that I thought of when I was including these foods in the list. Of course, there are many, many more, but this is just a starting point. And it's like gathering what's right around you. So, as a due disclaimer, I have included avocados. That's also because I live in Bangalore, and at this time of the year, we get avocados from Chikmagalur and Coorg, which come to us. And so it's local for us. So again, India is such a huge country with so many different microclimates. So what's local for me may not be local for someone in Delhi. And like Delhi, they get black carrots and whatnot in winter, which we don't get. So it's also about looking around you and choosing foods that are around you. So that was the first step. So now that we have the superfoods, we have how to eat them, we have the recipes, but just including superfoods like medicine in your diet, is it enough? So you have to go a few steps behind and examine how exactly are you eating? What are your food habits in general? What are the other things that you're eating in your diet? Because just including this alone is not going to change your food habits completely. So it's like incorporating all the other good habits, because if you're going to make a positive change, then why not do a complete overhaul? Why just change small bits of your diet? But why not look at eating more mindfully, eating with a certain set of rules that just help you overall in your wellness and, good health.
Yeah, I think you answered this so beautifully, because whenever anybody else talks about superfoods, it's about this is the food, this is how you can probably eat, this is the recipe, and this is the nutrition value. Nobody ever really bothers about which package it comes in, where it comes from, where it's sourced, and that makes all the difference. Also, while I think almost everyone is obsessed with healthy food, right, or eating some variation of food in a healthy manner that would like give them weight loss or fitness or whatever objective people chase, I think increasingly the problem with a lot of fitness influencers, and I'm just again personal POV, is that when they talk about food, it's always in terms of macros and calories. And and that's not how you think about food, right? Food is the adrak wali chai that you have first thing in the morning, or it's a wedding feast, or is that one gajar ka halwa that you have to have every winter. It's breaking down, I think, our relationship with food only to its nutritional component is very transactional. I think it really changes our relationship with food and distances us from it. It almost like weaponizes food or makes it a villain, saying, hey, you're eating chapati, this is like not good for you. Or don't eat rice, eat like some processed chicken that come in a packet which you like slather with like herbs and put it in the oven and call it a keto diet, right? Which is terrible, because it takes away all your cultural heritage. It takes away a lot of value that farmers and producers around you grow. And I think, and because I've always lived in urban cities, I always feel, and for a lot of people of my generation, where do you get your products or processed food or veggies from, right? You always get it near you. And unfortunately, a lot of us just order online. So we aren't seeing the produce. We don't know where it comes from. I think last year during COVID, like around my building, right, they started having this one guy who used to come from Nasik, and he would only get like specific sabzi that's grown there, and he wouldn't have any of the standard like red cabbage, yellow zucchini kind of thing that, you know, like I'm used to experimenting with in my recipes. And but, you know, I realized one thing, that I could keep his like sabzis forever, they wouldn't spoil because they were fresh. He would literally change whatever was coming. He knew ki what beej had gone into it, what soil, kis farmer ke khet pe wo uga tha. If he got eggs, like, you know, country eggs, he knew the name of the person, the plot of land on which the chicken was roaming around in. And that makes it far more special than, you know, somebody with like very toned abs telling me that, listen, count your macros in your matar paneer and in your dal makhni, right? It just takes away the fun of the food. For me, I think while the book obviously speaks about superfoods, but it's, as you said, right, it's very much about the multi-layered relationship with food. Also, the cultural anthropology and the history of food. You actually begin the book, Nandita, with this whole hunter versus farmer sort of background. What I think really out of, I'm sure you did like so much research, and you are a nutritionist, right? So you already have a background of so much information, which is probably a source or a book or even like a blog maybe, which you think is like a fantastic source of information about food, and that you would probably recommend to everyone and say that, hey, read my book, but after you're done reading my book, also like read this or watch this.
You made a lot of points, and you know, the earlier part about our relationship with food and how we're making it very transactional when we just count calories and macros is, you know, it is so very true. And although my earlier book, The Everyday Healthy Vegetarian, had the calorie count because, you know, I did a kind of a poll, and even we thought it's good to provide the macros, you know, in each recipe. But I consciously steered away from that in this book because, you know, all the recipes have ingredients that are good for you. And, you know, it's not necessary to, you know the calorie count of everything, because we are already setting the stage wherein, you know, you're putting mindful eating as one of the key principles around the book. And mindful eating means, eating with your full consciousness and being eating slowly, therefore being aware of when your full, the hunger scale, how hungry were you to start with? And because you're eating slowly, you realize that your hunger is slowly getting sated, and you stop when you're around 75% to 80% full. Like they say, you know, leave the party before it's over. Don't hang around until you're like completely stuffed and someone has to, you know, pull you off the table. So that doesn't happen if we eat fast in the first place. And if you follow this principle of mindful eating, you will automatically know your portion size and, you know, how much to eat. So the whole calorie and that aspect, I didn't find it necessary. But also this comes with practice. Even I'm still learning how to do it. It's not easy. And, you know, to be so focused and concentrated on your food, because over the years, we have all fallen into that bad habit of, okay, this is my lunch break, let me watch something. We actually decide what to watch before we sit down to eat. And so that you're not scrolling around while you're eating. So you want to know what you're going to watch or what are you going to do. That's become so much a part of our present day culture. So it's tough to, I'm not saying it's easy at all, but it's not tough. It's not that tough also that if you put it into practice in your everyday life, it's going to be impossible, because we're all born that way. So it's not tough to go back to our, our original state. So that's one aspect of it. And in terms of resources, I think I like what Dr. Mark Hyman writes. He's a functional medicine specialist. So he's a qualified medical professional, but he's also like in nutrition And he talks a lot of common sense. Then, of course, there's the food guru, Michael Pollan. I like all of his books. Again, they are rooted in common sense. And, you know, it's that his very famous quote, don't eat what your great-great-great-grandmother doesn't consider as food.
Right in the beginning of the book. Yeah. And I think that was the line that prompted my mother to go like, look, I've been telling you this too, and like, you're not buying anything from me.
So I think even you can't possibly go back to what your great-great-great-grandmother was doing, because those were completely different times. We live in completely different times. But at least take some key principles and, you know, some learnings from that. Like I talk about my great grandmother and my grandmother, and some things are there that we can pick up from what they did, you know. And actually, when you today, you know the science of it, and then you realize, oh, that's why they were doing that. You know, for example, when my grandmother used to make a big batch of dosa batter every week, and as a kid I used to be watching her, what she's doing. And in the end, like after the batter was filled in the removed from the machine and put it in the pot for fermenting, she would take a handful of rock salt, because it was a lot of batter, therefore a handful, and she would and it's rock salt, so it takes time to dissolve, right? It's not iodized salt. So she would put it in the batter and keep on mixing with her hand until you know, it dissolved. And I would think, why is she messing up her hands and everything? So I would think, why is she not using regular salt? And two, why is she not stirring with a, you know, a spatula or a stirrer? And today I realized that one, when you're trying to dissolve rock salt into batter, that means at least for 5 minutes you're mixing it with your hands, because when you use a stirrer, you will not exactly know where the salt is. So your hands tell you, because of the texture, they tell you where is the salt, and you massage it into the batter, and your hands, the surface of your hands have so many bacteria that they actually help aid fermentation when they get into the batter. So they give a kickstart to the whole fermentation process. And when I learned about it and I realized, I'm sure my grandmother didn't think of it, but she was doing things the absolutely right way without even knowing the science of it. So certain things we can, of course, you know, learn in retrospect when we put the science with the past culture, and when the two come together, it's always an aha moment, and you feel like, you know, wow, she was doing it the right way. Because some, we are a bit stupid, and we would like to think that our generation is always the smartest. So when we actually want to, you know, give full marks to our ancestors for doing something right, we always do it a bit condescendingly. But I will say wholeheartedly that a lot of things can be learned. And, you know, in the space of nutrition and food, every day there is a new theory coming out. One day eggs are good for you. One day they are poison. You know, currently everybody, a lot of people are following the keto diet, and we don't know what will happen 5-10 years down the line, what studies will say about it. There are so many fluctuations, right? And as human beings, we get adjusted to one thing and then something else comes up, and you know, like now people are guzzling coconut oil like it's
just swilling coconut oil also.
Like people are ready to drink coconut oil because it's so healthy for you. And some years ago, it was said it's a saturated fat, it's going to cause heart disease and all that. And, you know, so the best thing is not to keep swinging with every new study that comes in, and not to jump after every white paper that comes in. But if you follow something that your ancestors have followed for hundreds of years, and they've stayed in, it has, you know, kept them in good stead, and they've been healthy, and they've lived long, and they've not had any chronic ailments, given that their other aspects of their lifestyle was good, you know that that's not going to damage you. So I know that if I eat like 2 spoons of coconut oil or have a little bit of coconut every day, because my ancestors have been having that for hundreds of years, it's not going to kill me. So I think some amount of trust can be placed on the history and the culture, and not just jump and believe every new thing that comes your way. And if you see even my book, I have steered clear of any like these kind of findings that keep coming up on a day-to-day basis, but rather stick to long-term beliefs and knowledge.
You know, this makes me think of all the media agenda setting and which like people who are like media or communication professionals, they instinctively understand, right, that for everything which is advertised, there is a lobby.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's advertised or spoken about, right? So the reason that for a very long time people say built up fat and criticize sugar is probably because of sugar mills. The fact that people justified cornflakes and random colored cereal and institutionalized that as a breakfast practice in a country like the US is all driven by industry, driven by agendas, driven by profit. It's not really driven by the desire to see you well fed and happy, right? It's
absolutely not. That's not going to build the profit margins, one. And you bring up that very important point where breakfast as a concept did not exist in the world. If you look at hunter-gatherers, no animal was going to land up at 8 o'clock on a caveman's doorstep and say, hey, I'm your breakfast, eat me. So that's not happening, right? So they would eat when they were hungry, or if they caught something, that's when they would eat. So that whole concept didn't exist. But at the same time, someone who's a farmer who leaves home at 6 o'clock or whatever, he would actually have a hearty meal at maybe 5:30 in the morning to keep him full until whenever he finished his morning work or until he got access. There was not like a McDonald's or something right next to a farm where he could just pop in and have his breakfast. So it was a practical aspect of eating before you left home, because once you left home, there was no guarantee of where you would find your food next. And that whole concept of breakfast being good for you and it being the healthiest meal of the day, and that breakfast like a king and lunch like a queen and dinner like a pauper, that those things became so, they are still so popular. And, talking about how breakfast improves your health and causes weight loss and improves your metabolism. And people don't realize that for every such study, like you said, not just advertisement, even every study is sponsored by a brand or a lobby. Otherwise, why on earth is someone going to spend millions of dollars funding a study unless it's going to give them some result to benefit their own marketing reasons, right? So you should always think about any study that comes out, who is behind that study, and within 2 minutes, you will know why the result was the way it was. So I think this is a very important point you make, and we should all remember that no industry is here for our benefit. They're all there for their benefit. So the only person who can think of your benefit and your family's benefit is you. So this, it lies entirely in your hands.
I think for everyone listening to the podcast, this is a very good reminder. Every time you buy something, think about why someone's selling it and why you're eating it. And just answering that will take care of a lot of, impulse shopping, picking up candy bars or picking up granola bars or picking up randomly disguised healthy snacks, quinoa puffs and whatnot. I think one very other interesting aspect that you spoke of earlier, right, was the fact that we should eat food that's grown closer home. And I think one of the most interesting things is that what we consider as like food grown closer home is actually food that come to us from different cultures, right? So like everything from like aloo, mirchi, tomato, and all of these things weren't indigenous to India. We made it our own. And I think a lot of people, and I bring this point because I was speaking to someone about this, and this friend of mine, she kept insisting that there's no harm in like eating Norwegian salmon that come from somewhere or avocado that's come from somewhere, because look, Ayushi, even at the end of the day, the Portuguese bought chilies and whatnot. I think that might be the case, okay? But the fact that you're like, over a period of time, food also gets like culturalized, right? For instance, that example you gave of Bangalore and like butterfruit or avocado actually being an indigenous produce for you is very different from blueberries being an indigenous produce, right? This has just traveled all of these mild plastic boxes in like shipping containers or flight, right? So I think I find it like very amusing when a lot of people have these interesting arguments for and against food, and everyone has an opinion on food, like, and a variation this works and that works. So how do you, as an author, when you're writing about something about superfoods, what are the kind of reactions you receive, or do people come and tell you that acha, you've written this but ye to aisa hota hai, and you've written about like cabbage and broccoli, like and you know, do people react or have specific opinions over and above yours, Nandita? Do they come and tell you that, listen, you've written about this, but actually I know this is the right way? Or do they give you some interesting and completely bizarre reasoning, like, hey, I can eat blueberries because 300 years ago somebody bought chilies from Portugal to India?
No, I guess maybe not in response to my book, because I don't know if my audience is that active on social media and, you know, trying to, some of them are, but not so much. But definitely things I post on Instagram or Twitter is pretty similar to, you know, what I do on a daily basis is what goes on my social media. I don't have a separate plan or strategy for that. And I do get these kind of responses, like, you know, just yesterday I posted something for a homemade granola, which involved tossing all the ingredients, like the rolled oats, the nuts and the seeds, in honey, because you need something to coat it and bind it, and then bake it for like 30 to 40 minutes. So instantly somebody messaged me saying, but Ayurveda says you can't heat honey, it becomes toxic if you heat up the honey. I said, fair enough, Ayurveda says that, and I do believe in quite a few Ayurvedic principles, but I don't believe that purely by heating honey, it's going to become a poison or toxic, because I have done it quite a few times and nothing has happened. And in the West, honey is regularly used in cakes, baking and whatnot. And, you know, maybe it, you know, if it's like pure raw honey and it has some kind of, you know, things like pollen or some natural ingredients, which are heat labile, they may get, you know, destroyed on heating up, fair enough. But, you know, if you're using like a little bit of honey in something and you have heated it up, you're not actually eating that honey for its nutritional value. You're using it to add some flavor to your food. And especially like in a granola where I have like 10 other ingredients like seeds, nuts, other dried fruit, you know, fiber from oats, etc. I'm not exactly looking at honey to provide me all the nutrition in that dish. And it's sometimes we end up looking at ingredients so individually that we don't realize we are eating them as a part of a meal. And I'm not eating just honey, right? So I said that, see, if that really troubles you, then use liquid jaggery, because that we anyway heat up for chikki and all, it's regularly heated up, right? So, see, the thing is, if I had said use like sugar syrup, then someone would say, oh, it's highly processed. But if I say use honey, they'll say, oh, it's Ayurveda says no. And if I say use some maple syrup, they'll say, no, it's coming from Canada. So I'm sure everything, people, you know, nothing you write is going to fully satisfy anybody. And that's how it should be. I'm not saying everyone should have the same opinion and everybody's completely entitled. Even if someone comes and tells me everything you've written in the book is wrong, it's totally fine, because that's their opinion. And I got to write this book, so obviously I'm going to write my opinion. So it's, you know, it's totally fair. Like we, you know, a friend and I, we do this weekly talk on Clubhouse chat, and it's always about food, and we often talk about we have our opinions which we share, and we say, if you're going to come up and tell us that what you said is completely nonsense, we are totally fine with that, because if everybody just nodded their heads together at the same thing, then, you know, it's never going to be a fun discussion, and no one is ever going to grow or enrich each other with each other's thoughts and experiences. So when people come and tell me this is not the right way and that's wrong, in many times they are right, and I'm happy to accept, you know, maybe going forward I will use that. Like if someone had offered me a solution other than honey, which is not like crazy expensive like real maple syrup and not as processed as sugar, then I would happily accept that. So it's the question of having an open mind when it comes to, you know, food and nutrition. There's nothing set in stone. And, you know, I may say this today, but tomorrow, if I learn something new, I'll have to change my opinion. And that's how we continue to grow. I can't say that, you know, I wrote this or I said this, so I'm going to stick to that just for the heck of my ego or like, you know, standing by what I said. I don't believe in that. And I would rather keep changing and evolving.
I mean, I would say that's incredibly gracious of you, because a lot of people who write about food, especially in the context of nutrition, aren't always that open, Nandita. And I've actually heard you and I think Krish speak on Clubhouse. So I know it's like a great chat. And after you're done listening to the podcast, people who are listening to this podcast, and if you have Clubhouse, please go and check that out also.
Yes, we are on Thursdays at 9:30 as of now. So hopefully when this episode is out, the timing and the day still stays. But you can follow our club. It's called Masala Trail Weekly. So automatically you will come to know when we schedule the talks.
You know, with Masala Trail Weekly, I just realized one thing, that when, like, say even 10, 15 years ago, right, when people consumed content about food, right, and I am thinking of like a Khana Khazana days, right, it was always people who cooked, who consumed content about food. But now, even if you don't cook, right, I think a lot of people just love watching stuff or reading about food in general. So whether it's like a MasterChef or all of these.
I was just going to tell you about MasterChef Australia. It's going on for like 13 years now. And, you know, when we started watching it, maybe season 2 or 3, can you imagine half the things they were talking? We wouldn't even know what the hell is that ingredient. Yeah. And now, even though we don't cook those things, it's become like, you know, even our kids are having conversation about croque monsieur and things like the chocolate soil, where, you know, like we heard it for the first time, like, what the hell is this? So the more you hear, it just becomes so normalized to have these fancy terms thrown in at you. And whether you cook it or not doesn't matter, but you can see and appreciate. That's the thing about food, right? You could be in different in a different setting of that whole cycle, where you are just maybe watching, or maybe you are just reading about it, maybe you're just cooking a little bit, or you are a chef, or you could be any end of the spectrum, but you could still enjoy food.
Yeah, and now we live in an era where, you know, people are making like Panta Bhat and Hilda March and winning MasterChef. And people are like...
That's thrilling, actually.
Yeah.
Good fun.
Yes, and you know, it's really wonderful, I think, for people to consume content about food. I know like food porn and the number of Insta pages on like food, etc., gets like really a bad rep. But I still remember when I was in school, I think, and this has sort of stayed with me, like one of my teachers, and she was really old, she said that, you know, I was like, and she was a Punjabi lady, she said I was 45 or something when I first had a masala dosa. And you know, and by the time that, like, I'm sure that we'll be 45, I am sure I would have eaten like everything from Ethiopian food to Brazilian food, I mean Italian and Chinese and Japanese and Thai food is something that you like make like
now. They have become desi only. Italian is nothing but extension of Indian.
Yeah, and you know, this lady said that we wouldn't get dosa anywhere in Delhi. So the first time I had a masala dosa was this, and I thought ki isme kya badi baat hai. And I still remember that, you know, my friend, and she was Tamilian, her mother would make rasam when I was small, and I was so thrilled because I wouldn't get rasam at home. But now if I want to eat rasam, I can make it myself, or my mother makes it regularly, or I can just order it like in 15 minutes. So the entire gamut of what we eat has expanded so widely, I think, that it really affects our relationship with food. And I am going back to it thematically, but it's so true, right? If you only had 10 things to choose from eating, it wouldn't be a problem, because and I frequently, like in villages, right, where you are a farmer and you grow a few vegetables and you have one grain and you have two cows, that's all you eat, right? So you have that milk, you have those 3 or 4 vegetables, and you have like one wheat or one rice. But that's no longer the case for any of us, right? We all have so much to choose from.
The world is our kitchen, right?
Yeah,
now.
And that's why I think your book is important, because what it does is not I think it's not prescriptive. It just guides you that these are the avenues from which you should probably look at your food, sort of fix your own relationship, and then choose how you probably want to go about it. I also really like the fact that you have a section on lunchboxes, because for like it's something that doesn't get talked about often, because eating is almost always seen as either eating out or eating ghar ka khana, but then there is or takeaways and delivery, but very few people talk about eating home food and packing it and the kind of detailing. I thought was very interesting.
Thank you so much. I think the getting practical with superfoods was my favorite chapter, because knowledge on one hand is freely available on the internet and in a lot of other books as well, and someone who is keen on learning, they go after that knowledge and they get it anyway. But then implementing that in your daily life, implementing that knowledge in a way that it benefits you, is where the gap is. And that's the most important aspect of any learning, right? So I attended a few really good workshops in my life, and I kind of made those things a part of my life, like say soap making or sourdough. But the minute you come home and if you don't start, doing it the next day, what you learned is just going to evaporate from your head. So that's why that practical aspect of it is so important, and that I've spent a lot of time and pages on that, on how to incorporate these superfoods in your day-to-day life. It's just one thing to know that these are the best superfoods and these are the recipes. But then also things like menu planning, meal prep, which is when it's going to be practical to actually include these in your day, because everybody is busy. And if you're telling someone, hey, cook 3 meals a day and make sure you're including all these foods, it's not going to be easy for someone who's working and who has a full-time career to also do these things. So something like meal prep, where you have like on a holiday or a light work day, you make sure that some of these ingredients that you want to include during the week are prepped and kept in the fridge, which a lot of people get upset. Oh my God, how can you recommend eating stale food, nutrient loss, etc. But it's definitely better to include these foods with a marginal nutrition loss, which I don't think anything happens in the fridge or freezer. It pretty much maintains its state. That's the whole purpose of a fridge, to keep food without degrading. And if it enables you to choose better, then might as well you choose that with a possible nutrition loss than ordering out last minute without any plan, and you just are like a 10 on 10 on the hunger scale. You enter the kitchen and you will eat anything edible that you find. You don't want to find yourself in that situation if you want to eat healthy. And so therefore, the importance of meal planning, menu prepping, how to shop, having a shopping list, and also, things on swaps. So how, because everything I'm not going to possibly be able to give a recipe for. So if you're already eating a few things in your week, like say certain things for breakfast, certain things for lunch, how to make sure they are fortified with superfoods. That's another aspect I talk about in that chapter. So I think, and also what utensils to cook in, because you could be buying really good quality ingredients and superfoods, but how are you cooking those? And, is it in the best environment for that particular vegetable or produce that you're using? So also, because there's this whole confusion about can I use nonstick? Can I use anodized? Can I use aluminium? Cast iron, but it's too heavy. Stainless steel is too expensive. There's so many, so many gray areas in this, and so confusing. Like you go to Amazon and you type something, you are inundated with choices, right? And you don't know what to buy. So I thought, okay, because I have wasted a lot of time understanding what can I buy, what can I cook in. So I like to share some of that information as well. And like you said, even in our earlier times, the choices were so few. I know my grandmom had the same 3-4 kadais and, utensils, and there was nothing they could not make in that. But we have so many, and yet we are so confused. Like, we don't know. We want to buy more, and something nice and new comes in the market and you want to experience that and buy that. But also buy it with, putting some thought and be conscious about how long it's going to last. You know, is it something like a nonstick, which no matter how much you pay, you'll have to replace in 1.5 to 2 years? Or you're paying a little more and buying a heavy steel thing, which will last you 50 years or 60 years. So think about the long term and not just instantly that something looks good and you bought it, right? So a lot of these things are a part of our day-to-day life in the kitchen, either cooking, eating, and the whole process from end to end done more consciously is definitely going to benefit us enormously.
I think that I can, honestly, Nandita, I can like probably sit and keep listening to you, because not only did I immensely enjoy reading the book, but a lot of what you have written about, or even in general, right, stuff that you speak about in your interviews or through your posts, right, they're very approachable. So it's not to put like this, put yourself in like an ivory tower, right? It's food, but with approachability, even if it's with like choosing utensils, as you said, or meal prepping and things like that. And I think that that's what makes it special. And I also think, your kitchen garden, and because I live in Mumbai, I envy you for that. but it's so funny, you know, like your state, right? Your situations and circumstances really influence what you eat. So if you're in a smaller town, or if you have access to a house with a backyard or with a garden, you will always eat better than someone who doesn't, even if they like make more money or live like a more whatever influential lifestyle, if they're living in like a box. So I think that's also very interesting. And I also I think this was some interview I read where you said that you weren't sure what came first, the passion for cooking or this garden, and then both have sort of interweaved for you. And I think for a lot of people who are listening to this podcast and people who will go and look at the book, I think, you know, for me also while reading the book, I don't know if a lot of it was, while very tactical, right, in terms of recipes and practical tips, but it also helped me like reflect on a lot of my heritage, how I eat, what I eat. And I hope that for everyone who reads this book, they will also have the simultaneous experience where they don't know what came first. Much like the garden and the cooking and the recipes and the choice of what we're eating.
I'm so glad you say that. And I think that was very important to me while writing the book, that one, it's relatable, it's not intimidating, as is a lot of information when it comes to the science of cooking or like the nutrition aspect of food. Things tend to get complicated and, you know, quite tough to wrap your head around. And thirdly, also, it should be simple enough that it gives you time to reflect. Because if something is already written so complex that you're spending so much of your mental bandwidth just trying to understand that, that there's hardly that bandwidth left to reflect simultaneously as you read. And the fact that it made you do that, I think that's like the biggest gift for me from a reader, that you get to think about your own lifestyle and your eating habits and see where some changes can be made, or feel good if you're already on the right track. So that's really good to hear.
Thank you so much, Nandita. And to everyone listening to the podcast, please go buy Everyday Superfood. Actually, gift it to somebody also if you think that they would learn from it. A lot of times, folks, you know, buy books and keep them. But this is really a book that you should read, explore, and like use as a workbook almost, if I can say that. Everyday Superfoods by Nandita is available at independent bookstores. It's available at chain bookstores. Amazon, Flipkart has Kindle versions. So whichever, wherever, where, however you're reading, feel free to grab a copy of the book and do read it. And don't forget to follow Nandita on Instagram as Saffron Trail. She also has a website. She's active on Twitter. She shared details of her clubhouse. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. And I hope you all have a great day, evening, night, wherever you're and whenever you're listening to this.
Thank you, Ayushi. And thanks for the shout out and the very generous words about my book. And yeah, I do hope your listeners buy the book and explore it for themselves.
If you love listening to this podcast, do not forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcast fix from. Ensure that you do not miss a single episode by following us on Twitter and Instagram. Lastly, if you have some feedback for us, we would love to talk to you. Send your bouquets and brickbats at indiabookpodcast@gmail.com.